you should know that there's a abusive language in that the Higgs, that there's a Higgs doublet, which is phi, and we've chosen a gauge where phi is 0, you know, 1 over root 2, b plus h. So the real honest-to-God Higgs particle is the thing that h is describing. And so the Higgs boson, you know, the Higgs, the boson is this guy. Higgs, the doublet, is this whole thing. And people often just talk about the Higgs without telling you which is which, and the context tells you. But you shouldn't be expecting, in the end of the day, as you saw this morning, there to be a whole bunch of scalar particles in the theory. There's just the one because of this gauge freedom, which allows us to remove these 3 degrees of freedom. You know, where did they go? They went the same place that the phase degree of freedom in the scalar electrodynamics went. They were absorbed into, you know, the gauge transformation that allowed us to take a general phi and put it in this form puts the, has to, in order to be a symmetry, all the fields transform, not just phi. And so in particular, the gauge fields shift by a derivative, and that derivative, you know, so it gives it a longitudinal piece. So these three modes that have been eaten here are the three modes that you need to convert the W1, W2, and Z particles to become massive. They as massless particles, they had 2 spin states. As massive particles, they have 3. So you had to add 1 degree of freedom for each of them. And those 3 degrees of freedom were the 3 that we removed here. So that's where they went. So we're going to have 1 scalar particle, a neutral scalar particle, that's physically there. And the other 3 are really the longitudinal pieces of the W and the Z particles. The particle states, so in this separation we've got between the non-interacting and the interacting Hamiltonian, the particle states we define to be the ones that are describing the particles, you know, created around our vacuum at phi equals v. And that would correspond to, we'd have 1 spinless particle and then 3 massive x spin 1 particles. And so that's, so in the gauge we're using here anyway. Potential like that. I can't remember. Oh. This thing. Right. There was an issue as to the no particle state here, and you say call that one the no particle state, and you call this one the no particle state prime, if you like. And if you imagine expanding things in powers of phi, and here would be things in powers of phi minus v, if we'd only had one field, one complex field. That was the thing you're talking about? I can't remember, that's so long ago, I can't remember what I was saying, but I think, so the issue would be, I think, if you... So here's an attempt to I think I know what you're asking. So supposing that you put things in a big box and you cut things off, so there's a shortest wavelength, so there's a finite number of degrees of freedom here. So it's like quantum mechanics. Then I think it's true that you can think of the states. So these states we're imagining. What I would mean by the Fock space of states here would be that, you know, I've got these fields written in terms of, you know, it's an integral d3p of, you know, stuff involving creation operators. And then here I've got if I call this difference phi minus psi, I do the same sort of a decomposition, you know, with some creation operator b, let's say. Then we could define the state that, you know, these guys could be defined by the condition. Let me use a round thing rather than a square thing. You know, they could be so this could be defined by the condition that a for the various modes is zero, and this could be defined, this state here could be defined by the condition that this is zero, right? And then you could act on it by these various a stars to create new states. So one statement would be that you know, by comparing this to this, you could write a formula for how a is related to b. So there's going to be some statement like you know, a sub p is it's probably true that the zero mode, when p is equal to zero, a sub zero is probably b sub zero plus or minus v or something like that. There's some shift that you're doing that relates a and b, because the fields phi are shifted. And the only thing that's been shifted is a constant p, so it's the zero momentum mode. So plus some sort of constant. So then there's a question as to, in this, if we use this is a basis of states and this is a different basis of states, they should be writable in terms of each other. And then I think the thing I was saying the other day was that you can kind of think of them in terms of each other, you know, if this is true, that A is B plus C, then that means that if I apply A to zero, I'd get, you know, C. And so, you know, this ground state, or this state defined by by this condition, is, I could think of it as being an eigenstate of A, and not a zero eigenstate, but a non-zero eigenstate of A with eigenvalue C. And that kind of defines a coherent state. So there's a class of states you can solve this condition to write, you know, zero as being sum over the various particle states with some coefficient. So there's some sort of a formula for it's something like, you know, e to the a star on the ground state or something like that. There's some formula like this that with this there's a c in here somewhere that you can explicitly construct the linear combination of these basis states which satisfies this property. So you can express the what we're calling the particle states over here in terms of particle states over here. So that's a mathematics statement. And then the physical question is what, you know, the reason we're interested in these particle states was that they were actually eigenstates of some free Hamiltonian. And so it's only these ones that have a sensible interpretation in that language, because when we write H is equal to H naught plus, you know, H int, and we could do the same thing up here with the difference H naught because we've shifted the fields. It's only here that all the particle states have a reasonable, you know, all the modes evolve by some phase rather than growing or being damped exponentially, because the ones up here, there's always some momentum modes which have a negative mass squared, and so that their mass is imaginary, and so that means that there's an imaginary component to their energy, and so that means there's an instability corresponding to the fact that the zero momentum would actually like to run off down the hill here. And so so although you can define these states, they're not really usefully they're the eigenstates of a mathematics problem, which is the quadratic part of the Hamiltonian here. But that's not a good approximation. The eigenstates of the full H are not well described as being small perturbations of the eigenstates of this thing. So these are the ones that are more useful from the physics problem of trying to have a free Hamiltonian, which is a good approximation of the full Hamiltonian. But if you don't care about being eigenstates of Hamiltonians, you can ask questions about if you just define them in terms of these destruction operators, regardless of whether or not that's also diagonalizing a Hamiltonian, then you can relate the one to the other, and the fact that you're allowed to have a non-zero value for the scalar field corresponds to the fact that you can construct states like this where you multiply populate. You can only do it because they're bosons. You're allowed to take repeatedly apply creation operators because these are all the zero mode that's being this one mode, and the fact that you can repeatedly apply creation operators to the state and get something interesting rather than getting zero. If it had been a fermion, you would have had to stop after you did it twice because of the exclusion principle. So the fact that you have this possibility of making a very complicated linear combination of these multiply occupied states that allows you to classically think about there being a minimum that's away from zero, which you wouldn't have done for the fermions because you could never get an interesting number of fermions into the state because once you had two, you're not allowed to do it anymore. So if I take this state, you're saying, if I take this state and I ask how many of these A particles are in it, the thing is that but when you say particles being there, you know, what a particle, it depends what you mean by particle, but what a particle to me means is that there's some sort of a limit in which you can turn this thing off. And so the real eigenstates of the system are being well described by the eigenstates of a non-interacting system, which isn't always true. But if it is true, that would be what it would mean to have particles, because they're, you know, to a good approximation, you can have one or two or three of them, and the energy is more or less adding, maybe with small interaction energy. But if it was really true that you can always define some random combination of these A's, take linear combinations of A with A star, such that it satisfies the result, satisfies the creation annihilation operator algebra, and then you can always define a Fock space. And most of those things are going to not be a good approximation to eigenstates of a Hamiltonian, which is close to the full Hamiltonian of your system. And so in those cases, I wouldn't call those particles, just because you've got an algebra like this, the A's and A stars, which you've chosen to, you know, build a Fock space out of. Well, here I would have said that these states don't diagonalize. You know, if you take A star A, it's a very well posed question: is this state an eigenstate of that? And it's not. So so in that sense, it doesn't have it. Well, the uncertainty principle will say that I can't tell you specifically exactly how many particles are there, if you mean by particles the A's. There's a story about the accelerated observers is a slightly different story, because that's the story there is that you're thinking about what, sorry? Like unruh radiation. Yeah, that's kind of related to the accelerating observer story, and the issue is you had to agree on what H was, and there's an ambiguity. You know, if you have a Poincaré invariance, you've got the translation generators and you've got the boost generators, or say J0 nu. And then in this case, so what we're doing is we're taking P0 to be the Hamiltonian. But all you really had to do was to have in a curved space, what you're asking is that there was a symmetry in the problem corresponding to time translation invariance. So that means that you're looking for a killing vector which is time-like. And if there's more than one, then you have to choose what the linear combination is that is the important one. And in Minkowski space, you could use, you know, dt as a killing vector which corresponds to, so if your killing vector is you know, c mu is delta mu zero, then that corresponds to choosing the Hamiltonian. The thing that generates translations in this direction is this Hamiltonian. But if you've chosen a killing vector, which is a linear combination of the, you've got a 10-parameter family of killing vectors here at some level corresponding to the rotations and the translations. And so if you take the boost or a combination of the boost and the translation, or you can take translations and rotations, there's various linear combinations of these killing vectors which generate different kinds of time. And some of them are unitarily equivalent to others, and some of them, and in particular the accelerating ones, not unitarily equivalent to the translation one. And so in specific cases like that where you've got more than one option as to what time translation means, that's where you start seeing the, and it typically, the ones that are different from inequivalent to one another are the ones that have horizons where there's a, the Cauchy problem for, in Minkowski space, the accelerated guys all live on one side of this wedge. And so this other side is something which they never see. And so a state, if you had an accelerating mirror or something, that would be the thing that would prepare one of the accelerated vacua. And it's physically different than the Minkowski one because it really has a different kind of initial data. And it's at some level, the reason it's kind of thermal or mixed is that you're tracing out a whole sector that you're not even seeing here. So you can get a non-pure state description in terms of the, if you start with a Minkowski vacuum and then trace over what you don't see, you've got a mixed description of what you are seeing when you've got a mirror. But that's kind of a separate issue from the kind of thing that's going on here. Let me get my brush. Where did I put my brush? Where is it? Yeah, but I thought I actually had the brushes out at one point. This is where I could have sworn I had it a second. Oh, hey there, now right in front of me. Well, actually, that's a bad idea. So I'll never forget that it's there. Right, so we did the expansion, and this became, it was minus 1/2 d mu Higgs, d mu Higgs. And we expanded the whole potential out, and we got minus lambda v squared Higgs squared minus lambda v Higgs cubed minus lambda over 4 Higgs to the fourth. And then we had this thing boiled down to minus 1/8 g2 squared v squared. I was calling these the upper ones before. And it was, since I'm writing the whole thing, this is actually v plus 8 squared. Right. So, no masses for the gluons, because the Higgs field didn't carry those masses. No masses for the photon, because, so why not? So the last thing I talked about was the photon is massless for the photon. It was d mu cos theta plus w3 mu sine theta. Now you're going to see that the this thing being massless corresponds. What we found earlier was that when we had a scalar field that was non-zero, if the gauge symmetry corresponding to the spin one particle is broken by that scalar field, then the gauge particle gets a mass, like these guys did. But if there's a gauge symmetry which is not broken by the scalar field, then it's like the scalar field was zero. It doesn't really care that the scalar field's non-zero, and so it doesn't get a mass. So the fact we've got a massless guy there makes you suspect that there's a symmetry which this thing has not broken. And that's what I want to identify next. So if we go back to the transformation law for phi and ask, is the vacuum invariant? So I want to know if I want to take this variation, I want to evaluate it at phi equals 0, you know, v over root 2, and I ask, is that 0? So when is? That would be the, if this is 0, that's the statement that the vacuum is invariant under the particular transformation we did. So all we have to do is write out the transformation rule for phi, and that was, you remember, it had hypercharge 1/2, right? So it's I over 2 omega 1 times phi. And then there was, it was a doublet, so it had I over 2 omega 2a poly matrix A times phi. So if, again, we write everything out as a matrix like we have been doing, this is I over 2, we've got omega 1 on the diagonal. I'm going to evaluate this at the vacuum, so this is at 0 v over root 2. And on the off diagonal terms, I've got, on the diagonal terms, I've got plus omega 3 and minus omega 3. And on the off diagonals, I've got omega 1 minus I omega 2. Here I've got omega 1 plus I omega 2. So I hope it's clear what I'm doing here is I'm just taking the three Pauli matrices explicitly and writing them out with these coefficients and using the fact that tau 3 is 1 minus 1, tau 1 is 1, has ones that are in this these slots, and tau 2 has minus I and I in this slot. And then this is the unit matrix, so it's got a 1 in both slots. So if I just do the matrix multiplication, this is just I over 2 root 2. IV over 2 root 2 times, you know, this fits that. So I've got omega 1, 2 minus I, omega 2, 2, and omega 1 minus omega 3, 2. And so if we want this to be 0, that's 0 if and only if omega 1, 2 is equal to omega 2, 2 is equal to 0, because this is a complex thing being 0. And this real thing can be 0 if omega 1 is equal to omega 3, 2. So we just call that omega. It doesn't have to be 0. So that transformation where we're doing a rotation in the third direction of the SU2 space and a U1 rotation, but with the same parameter together, is one which does not change this particular form for the vacuum. So that's a symmetry that hasn't been broken. So the four parameters in the symmetry, three of them have been broken because these two had to be 0. And these two had to be equal if we wanted to make the vacuum be invariant. But there was one that wasn't broken, and this is the one. So that's the thing that corresponds to the existence of a mass. The fact that we've got an unbroken symmetry is why we have a massless spin one guy in the spectrum. And that's also why these two guys had the same mass, and you might have worried, if they have the same mass to start off with, it might be that their masses are split once we put in perturbations. But they won't be split because the same symmetry is what relates these two things, and so it keeps them the same mass. So this symmetry of the vacuum is what I'm calling U1 electromagnetism. It's also sometimes called UQ electromagnetism because Q is the generator of magnetism. And under it, you know, if I ask how the various fields transform, so remember the gauge transformation rule for W, the SU2 thing was just, it was d mu omega A plus or minus, I can never remember which, minus epsilon A, B, C, omega B, 2, W, C, mu. So if I restrict myself to a constant transformation for now, a one that's varying in space, I can always choose a gauge. I can choose a gauge which will restrict the freedom to let omega vary in space. And I want to focus on the analog of an electric charge rotation, which is, if I think about if this is electromagnetic transformation, this is the symmetry that goes with conservation of electric charge, then if I imagine doing a transformation like this on electrons, say that's the thing that corresponds to the freedom to rotate the phase of an electron by, or the field of an electron by a phase. And the one that corresponds to when we coupled to the photon, we had to gauge the symmetry, but the original symmetry which was responsible for the conservation law was a global symmetry where we had a constant transformation. And I want to go back and ask, how does this field transform under that constant transformation? And that corresponds to this transformation where these are equal, but I want to also restrict to the case where this is not varying in space and time. So that allows me to drop this term. So if we choose d mu omega equals 0. So if I restrict myself now to this, these are 0 and these ones are equal and constant, then this would become minus epsilon a, b, and this will only be non-zero when b is 3, because that's the only one that's not, so a, 3, c, omega. So that means that since epsilon is the completely anti-symmetric symbol, this is only non-zero if a and c are 1 and 2. So this says that delta W3 mu is equal to 0, but delta W1 mu is equal to, you know, epsilon 1, 3, 2 is minus 1. So that's equal to omega W2 mu. And delta W2 mu is equal to minus omega W1 mu. And so that's another way of saying that there's a, you know, the delta of W1 mu, W2 mu, is, you know, 0, 1, minus 1, 0, times omega. And that's an infinitesimal orthogonal transformation. If I exponentiate this, this is an anti-symmetric matrix, I'm going to get something which is an orthogonal transformation, because same reason that exponentiating a Hermitian matrix gives me a unitary transformation, exponentiating an anti-symmetric matrix gives me an orthogonal transformation. So this is an O2 transformation. Or another way of saying it is that if I define W mu, the complex field, to be W1 mu minus I W2 mu divided by root 2, just conventionally the root 2, then this transformation corresponds to delta W mu is equal to W2 is equal to minus omega W1, so it's going to be minus I omega W mu. So that actually corresponds to W, the finite transformation would be e to the minus I omega W mu. And that's, when I did this for the electron, I wrote this as being e to the I times charge times omega. So this says that, that this W is the thing that's destroying a negative charge negative one particle. So this complex W destroys the charge minus one particle, spin one particle. So because there's a symmetry that relates W1 to W2, and because that symmetry is a symmetry of the ground state, then we know that it's going to be true that the states that are related by the symmetry have to have exactly the same energy. And the only time that that ever fails is if the ground state is not invariant. In this case, the ground state is invariant, so we should expect that it's an exact statement that these guys will have the same mass, and that's why it's useful to think in terms of a complex field W, because it's electrically charged, and that's why this leading order prediction that these masses are equal is an exact statement, and that's why the symmetries are so useful. The value of the mass as a function of G2 and V can get corrections in perturbation theory, but it'll be the same corrections for these two things because they have to have exactly the same mass because of the symmetry. And it's also why the mass of this photon, even you might have worried that it's zero to leading order in perturbation theory, but once we put the perturbations in, maybe it gets perturbed up to some non-zero value. It can't because this gauge invariance, the symmetry, is not broken by the vacuum, and so that's protecting its mass and keeping it exactly zero. So this is something which we know is an exact statement because of the symmetry, and the equivalence of these two masses is also an exact statement. But the explicit values of this mass and the ratio is not an exact statement. That's a leading order in perturbation theory statement. Right, now what about the fermions? The brushes are all over here. Well, the taus are there. You remember this transformation rule came from the condition that you could think of it as that's the condition that d phi transformed in the same way as phi did. And so where this was d, you know, minus I over 2 g2 a mu tau a phi. And so the thing is that the variation of this will have a Pauli matrix in it. But it'll only have a Pauli matrix because the variation of this will combine with the variation of this to give me a Pauli matrix. And so one way of saying that is that this is the tau says that the phi is transforming as a doublet, but the a's are transforming as a triplet because there's three of them. And in for SU2, it's the rules of combining products is the same as that is spin. So it's if I combine a spin a half with a spin one, I get a spin a half. Half of the one is a spin. A half plus a spin three halves, right? So the spin a half part is again something which has a Pauli matrix in it. And so the fact that this thing transformed in this way with no Pauli matrices is a statement it's a triplet, but that's what you needed to make this thing transform as a doublet. This whole thing transform as a doublet the same way that phi did. So if you go back if you think about it, the Pauli matrix it's a 2x2 matrix, it has to act on something which has got two indices. Which I've never writing here, but this is really column vector, two indices. This W, this A is running from 1 to 3, because there's one for every Pauli matrix. So it's not a two-index object. So that's why there's never a Pauli matrix in its transformation rule. Any other questions about that? So now we take the Yukawa couplings, do the same thing. It's we had minus Fij L bar I, gamma right, Pj I, Gij Q bar I. J phi. And we're supposed to, so now it's useful to actually think of writing this out like I was doing before as a column vector. So let me, there's too many brackets here, so let me write this as being this is nu bar I. E bar I transpose with that one. This one is. And let me write this one out too. This is 0, 1 over root 2. Let me write the 1 over root 2 out front here. V plus H. Here I've got up bar I, down bar I. This is again 0, V plus H. And this was 0, 1, minus 1, 0, V plus H in the upper slot, 0. And remember, this is here because this is in the upper slot because we had the complex conjugate, which didn't do anything because that was real, but then multiplied by the anti-symmetric matrix, which raised the non-zero thing from here to here. And we needed to do that because we had to get the hypercharge to work here. And the hypercharge of this one was different from this one. So if you write that out, that's the zero lops off the top one in these cases. So you're going to get minus 1 over root 2 Fij E bar I gamma right J. Gij E bar I gamma right dj So because these guys, so what's happening is that we're pairing off this, the left-handed electron field with the right-handed electron field. And we're doing the same thing for the left and right down and up quark fields. And so it's useful to at this point, rewrite things in terms of, in the same way that it's useful to rewrite the W couplings in terms of the complex W field, because although you can always trade any function of W1 and W2 for some other function of W and W star, a random function of W1 and W2 that's not invariant under rotations, O2 rotations, is going to be a function that involves W squared, W star squared, and W star. A symmetric function where you have this O2 invariance is going to be a function typically of WW star. It's a simpler expression when written in terms of the W's, because this way of writing the symmetry simplifies it. The same thing's true for these fermions. These guys both carry the electric, you know, we've designed this whole thing so that Q equals T3 plus Y is a symmetry. And so this is the thing which corresponds to this condition, in the sense that if I take T3 plus Y and I ask, is this the thing that's non-zero here, what's its quantum number under T3 plus Y? It's zero, because this thing is T3 is minus a half and Y was plus a half, and so that's canceling and giving me zero. So this particular charge is the one which is annihilating phi. And so that's the generator, which is corresponding to this choice of parameters when acting on the fermions. So this thing, we know how it acts on these various components. And they have the left-handed pieces of these two things are opposite. That's why this term is invariant. And the left-handed pieces of these things transform oppositely, and that's why they're invariant. And the left-handed pieces here are transforming oppositely, and that's why they're invariant. And that's not a miracle, because we chose the Y's to make those things be the electric charges of those things. So, thank you. Yeah. So the final line there is that in the same way it's convenient notationally to write the W's in terms of complex fields, it's convenient notationally to write the electrons and the quarks in terms of Dirac spinners, because they have a symmetry, a U1 symmetry, which relates their two Majorana components. They're going to find all these pennies in the end of the day here. And it's just a convenient, it's a notational convenience. If we you can take any pair of Majorana spinners and write them in terms of a Dirac spinner and its conjugate, but you get an ugly looking answer unless it's got the symmetry, a U1 symmetry that relates the two. So I'm regretting my notation a little bit. In the book, what I did is I actually called the Majorana spinner curly E, and I called the Majorana spinner here curly U, curly D, because I want to save the uncurly things for the Dirac spinner. And so let me do that here now in something that I used to hate when I was a student, when people changed notation on the board. But sorry about that. Let me just do that, because I'm going to switch this notation, and we'll never go back to the Majorana notation for these guys again for a while. So it's convenient to define. So conservation of Q, in the sense that Q leaves the vacuum invariant, makes it convenient to use Dirac spinners for leptons, for the charged leptons and quarks. So let's define the electron-like field to be, its left-handed piece is what I called E, and its right-handed piece is the Majorana spinner I called E. So this does what I've been saying. This is building in the left-handed piece of this thing is this thing, and I gave it the quantum numbers. I arranged the quantum numbers of the left-handed part of this Majorana field to be that of the left-handed electron. And I chose the left-handed piece of this thing to be the left-handed positron so that the right-handed piece would be the ferric quantum numbers of the electron, because I wanted to make this definition later on. Same thing for the quarks. And then things like, yeah, I'm not doing this for the neutrinos deliberately, yeah. Because there's not a right-handed part so far. And I'm doing this prematurely because there's something I want to do first. I want to diagonalize the masses first. So let me hold that thought. We'll do this in a second. But first, before we do that, let me just do something else here. So the mass terms just correspond to just crossing the H off here, right? So we've got L fermion mass is minus V over root 2 Fij So this is what I should have said first, that now I know I'm always free to do rotations amongst these unitary rotations amongst the fields that have the same gauge quantum numbers. Actually, I can do unitary transformations amongst all, if I wrote all the left-handed fields as a big column vector, if I do unitary rotations amongst those left-handed fields, I don't change the kinetic terms. That's something which I showed you before when we were talking about N fermions. But in the standard model, we also had gauge couplings. We had covariant derivatives, not ordinary derivatives. And so we could ask if the transformations we're doing are going to preserve the form of the gauge interactions. And that's, in general, the general unitary transformation won't. The transformations, the rotations amongst these fermions which preserve the form of the gauge interactions are those essentially which correspond to the rotating the fields that transform the same way under the gauge symmetries. So if I want to have a transformation amongst these fields, these fermion fields, which doesn't change the gauge interactions or the kinetic terms, then I'm forced to only rotate the three electron type things into one another, the left-handed ones, the right-handed electron ones amongst themselves, and the d's amongst themselves, and the uncurly d's amongst themselves. I'm not free to rotate d's into u's and things like that. I could rotate e's into d's and u's and not ruin the kinetic terms of the fermions, but I would ruin the gauge interactions because, for instance, the gluons coupled to the quarks and not to the E's, and so if I start shuffling them, I'll screw up the gauge interactions. So I want to use that freedom to redefine these guys, to rotate amongst these fields, to diagonalize these masses. And I know that I'm always going to be able to diagonalize them, and not only that, to make the diagonal entries non-negative. So what we'll do is we'll take EI, say gamma right, EI goes to what do we call this? U E I J gamma right E J prime gamma right E I goes to V E I J gamma right E J prime and so on for the quark. So we'll take gamma right and so under that transformation, you remember what happens to the mass terms is that the Fij goes to U transpose E F E I J. And Gij is going to go similarly to U down transpose G V down I J. And Hij goes to U up transpose H, V up, I J. Now, it's always possible to choose U and V such that it's important to say that these U's are all unitary. U's and V's are all unitary. I can say that somewhere. Otherwise, if they're not unitary, I screw up the kinetic terms. Now, we saw in general that I can always choose these Fs are not symmetric, right? Because there's a different fields on both sides here. The Gs are not, and the Hs are not. But if I had written the a big column vector out for of the form of all the left-handed fields, so I took gamma left, EI, EI, you know, UI, curly UI, and so on. If I written the mass matrix out for this column vector of left-handed fields, I would have necessarily had a symmetric matrix in this larger space as a mass matrix. And then these rotations are special cases of unitary rotation of these things, which I know I can always choose to diagonalize that overall mass term. That big symmetric mass matrix is going to have as off-diagonal blocks F on the upper left side and then F transpose on the lower left side. And that's how the whole matrix will become symmetric. And so the fact that I can always, so that tells me that I'm always free to choose these U's and V's in such a way that once I'm done, these matrices F, G, and H are all diagonal. And so F1, F2, F3, where F1, F2, and F3 are non-negative. That's something which I showed you in general for N fermions before. So let's do that. So we've done these rotations. And for looking at the mass terms, it's not going to be a big deal. I'm not going to really care so much about what the form of the U's and V's are. But keep in mind that I've done this, because when we go back and look at the interaction terms, we're going to have to, if we want to write them in the mass basis for which the masses are diagonal, which is the canonical basis, we have to make sure that we keep track of how the interaction terms change when we do this redefinition. And that's going to play an important role in the weak interactions. So once we've done that, then the mass terms, in fact, and the interactions, because they just differ by adding V goes to V plus H, F tau becomes minus V plus H over root 2 I'll write the sum now explicitly because there's only one index. Phi So I do the same thing for the up and down quarks as well. And so now what I want to do is go to this Dirac basis. So again, EI is gamma left, EI plus gamma right, EI. And then that simplifies because the complex conjugate can be combined with the left and right-handed parts are easily combined with one another. So then what happens is that things like we have epsilon bar I. See, F is now real, right? So epsilon bar gamma right is epsilon fi. And you remember when I do the complex conjugate for Majorana fields, the gamma 5 changes sign and the 1 doesn't. So this becomes epsilon bar I gamma left. But if I use these definitions here, then I can this is the same thing as saying this is gamma right E is the same thing as gamma right Dirac E, and gamma. So I can replace all these fields by I think of this being this is E dagger beta gamma right. That means it's gamma left acting on curly E. But gamma left acting on curly E is the same thing as gamma left acting on the Dirac E, because if I hit this with gamma left, this gives me gamma left again, but that kills this term. Gamma right acting on Dirac E is the same thing as gamma right acting on capital E, because the gamma right kills that one. So I can, for free, replace this with epsilon bar I gamma right plus gamma left EI. And then gamma right plus gamma left is 1. So this is just epsilon bar I epsilon EI. So that's the kind of the Dirac mass term that you know and love. And there's a root 2 that I wasn't careful about. So yeah, no, that's okay. That's the that was the Majorana nature allowed me to do that. So, but the statement was, if I have psi 1, m psi 2 complex conjugate for Majorana spinners, that's psi 1 bar plus or minus m psi 2, where the sign here is plus for scalar vector and tensor, and minus for pseudoscalar and axial vector. But where the ones and twos are on the same sign. So that just says that this thing, whenever there's a gamma 5, is effectively imaginary, and if these are both Majorana. So what you're saying is right. If I complex conjugate this thing, I change the order, but because they're Majorana, I can change them back again. And that's important in getting the sign right. And now I'm worried about factors of 1/2, and that's because in the same way that I just erased, W mu, when you have a complex field expressed in terms of its real imaginary components, there's a conventional 1 over root 2 that's always put in. And that's because you want the creation annihilation operators for the real parts to satisfy Dirac algebra, creation annihilation operator algebra. And if you want these things, if you write this in terms of creation annihilation operators for complex particles, and you want it to satisfy also a creation annihilation operator algebra, the 1 over 2 is required to get the algebra to work. So the same thing's true here, that we need a 1 over root 2. I say that, and I think it's true that that's true, but I think that there's also, I think, a convention that I didn't do right. Don't tell me I got that wrong. Here, I think I've actually made a mistake, and not in a way which is going to be important, but it's right. Can I be where here? Yeah, but the important thing is that for this term, so think of this as being epsilon bar, that's epsilon dagger I beta gamma right. And so that's epsilon I dagger gamma left beta, because gamma left, gamma 5 anti-commutes with beta, which beta is gamma 0, basically. So this is, you know, gamma left epsilon dagger beta. So everywhere I've got a gamma left, I can for free replace it by gamma left E. So that's what I've done here. Oh, you're worried about the... No, you see, what's happening is the gamma right is projecting out the piece that's purely left-handed here, and the gamma left here is projecting out the other one here. So if we do the same exercise on this one, this is epsilon dagger gamma right beta, and so that's gamma right epsilon dagger beta, and that's the one that's same as gamma right E. No, I'm lying to you. Let me rewind here. That's what's bothering you. You're worried about the fact that it's... So gamma right on E is equal to gamma right on E. And you're worried that you got gamma right on curly E. Right. So I've given the result's true, but I'm giving it to you. I'm explaining it wrong then. Gamma left on curly E. So these are the things we want to use. So let me think about it. I can certainly freely have them switch sides, because it's also true that, you know, psi 1 bar m psi 2 is equal to psi 2 bar m psi 1 plus or minus, but that plus or minus is plus for scalar, pseudoscalar, and axial vector, and it's minus for vector and tensor. So we're talking about these two, so I can change the order for free. I'm happy to do that. This is what you want to do? Tell me what to write. What would you like to write? Let me just... That's certainly the same thing, because this is a symmetric under the interchange of the two spinners. Ah, but do you believe these are the key identities I'm using, and it's counterintuitive for the Majorana spinners a little bit, because so what I was writing about the gamma lefts, so this is true, but when I had the gamma rights here, we have to be more careful about the... For Majorana spinners, the other guy is the complex conjugate of the first guy we're following. And so if you follow that through because they're Majorana, that makes these things the same. Have you done that in the... That's kind of why this is in the homework, is that it's counterintuitive. But so you're saying that now, having written it this way, you like this better because the... Yeah, but what's bothering... right. It's easier to see this way. The argument I made, if I make the argument again that I just made, with this way of writing it, it'll be clearer, right? Because you're saying that's the same thing as gamma right E. And if I took it the other way, I really have gamma left curly E bar, and that's the same thing as gamma left E bar. So that for this term... Literally, the argument I gave you allows me to write this as being E bar gamma right E. And having written this way, then I can make the same argument again and write it that way. So it's true the way I explained it the first time, I should have changed the order. All it really means is that if I've been more careful about explaining it without changing the order, it's still true. It's just harder to see. It's just that you have to keep track of the complex conjugate in here. That's there. So the bottom line is that you're getting, you know, mass term you know and love. And so so if I go back here now, write the what we got for the whole story. We have, so I'm hesitating here about these 1 over root 2s, because I think that actually this is wrong in the book. We forgot to do this. It's not going to make a difference in the formula we're going to get to, but there's an intermediate step. The convention is the same as, for the same reason, the convention is that there's a 1 over root 2 between Majorana and Dirac parts. Actually, no, there's not. Actually, let me rewind. I think, no, we got it right. Got it right. Because, so we have to do the, we have to look at the kinetic terms. So let's just do it. So what we've got so far is that the Yukawa piece is minus V plus H over root 2, sum over I equals 1 to 3 of Fi E bar I E plus Gi D bar I D plus Hi U bar I U. Now let me go back to the kinetic terms to see how they come together, because to read off the mass, what we have to do is read off, it's the, what, we have to have the kinetic terms in canonical form. And for a Dirac spinner, the canonical form, for a Majorana spinner, remember, the kinetic terms were minus 1/2 E bar I D slash E I minus 1/2 E bar I D slash E I. So, whereas the canonical normalization for a Dirac spinner is to have not without the halves, in the same way that the canonical kinetic term for real fields is 1/2 d mu phi d mu phi, but for the complex field was just minus d mu phi star. Again, because of this commutation, getting the commutation algebra right. So, I think actually I withdraw these 1 over 2s because I think this is going to work. So claim is that this is, so what's the best way to rewrite this? If I do this on the board, what you want to do is insert 1 is equal to gamma left plus gamma right here. And then repeat the argument made here for the kinetic terms, but keeping in mind that there's an extra gamma matrix hidden in this. And if when you change the order of things, you have to integrate by parts to put the derivative back where it belongs on the right-hand side. So doing those steps, the claim is that you'll find that you get two copies of everything and that the halves go away. So this is minus E bar I D slash E I. So check this. So, having said that, now we can, if you compare this and this with the standard form, the canonical form from which we knew we could read off the mass, which was psi bar d slash plus m minus psi bar psi. If we keep track of the minus d slash, we just have to read off the mass as being what's left here. So the mass of the fermions, so the electron fermions are E sub I as a mass, which is 1 over root 2 F sub I times V. The down type fermions have a mass, which is 1 over root 2 G sub I times V. And the up type fermion has 1 over root 2 HI times V. But we also can see the Yukawa couplings here between the Higgs and the fermions. And so one of the nice things is that the same transformation that diagonalized the masses automatically diagonalized the couplings. Right? So this is an analog of the, we had this mass formula for the gauge bosons, which said that the MW over MZ was cosine theta W. So So one important thing is that the Yukawa couplings are diagonal in flavor space. When written in the mass basin. So we don't have an EI, a Higgs EI EJ term here. And in one of the exercises, you do this for two doublets. And it's not generically true. If you have two doublets with arbitrary couplings for each of the doublets, you can get things which would couple a muon to an electron, say. And so you have processes where a Higgs boson could produce a mu electron pair, say, or a muon could turn into an electron and emit a Higgs, which are never seen. And so this is a huge success of, no one's seen the Higgs, but even if the Higgs had not is too heavy to be seen directly, virtual effects involving only the particles we do see, but which change the flavor, electron to muon number, would be enormous compared to what's been measured. You know that processes like mu to e gamma happen less than 1 every 10 to the 12th decay or something like that. So it's consistent with never happening at all. And there's strong limits on the existence of couplings like this, where these things are different generations. It's also true that just like in the case of the gauge couplings, because V sets the scale for the masses again, ratios of masses are really set by ratios of Yukawa couplings. So the Yukawa coupling, if we write the Yukawa couplings in the mass basis as being minus some coupling Y times the Higgs times the fermion. So Y has a fermion, fermion bar fermion. Then this thing is given by F over root 2, right? So it's corresponding, it's F over root 2, or it's G over root 2, or H over root 2. But that's just the mass divided by V. So this is always the mass of the corresponding fermion divided by V. So that's the better way to think about these couplings, is that the heavier the mass, the stronger you couple to this Higgs. That was also true for the Higgs itself. The Higgs mass was proportional to the self-coupling of the Higgs, the lambda term in the scalar potential. And the gauge boson masses were proportional to the gauge couplings. So the Higgs couples to the gauge fields like everybody else in a strength proportional to the gauge couplings. But the gauge couplings are the mass of the gauge bosons divided by V. And so it's a universal property of the Higgs field particle that it's coupling to everybody proportional to its mass. And so you should expect it to couple most strongly to the heaviest things around. And right away we can ask, we're doing all this thinking that perturbation theory is going to work. What's the biggest mass that we know about? The biggest mass that the Higgs of the particles, the Higgs couples to itself, but we don't know the Higgs mass at all, so we don't know how big that coupling is. But as long as the Higgs is less than, a TeV or so, that coupling should be perturbative, say maybe 500 GeV. But if of all the other things, the heaviest, the top quark is the heaviest of everybody else. It's about 180 GeV, whereas V is something like 246 GeV. And the size of perturbative corrections, the perturbative series, you might think that this divided by this is like it's like two-thirds or something, right? That doesn't sound so good. But the thing that controls perturbation theory is really things like y squared over 4 pi. In the same way that the electric charge E is only 0.3, but the thing that counts perturbation theory is really the fine structure constant, which is E squared over 4 pi. And so so this y is order 1, but the 1 over 4 pi means that the series you're doing is actually pretty good, just like E is 0.3, and that's why this series is pretty good. So in practice, the Yukawa couplings actually are all small because the masses are all small. And generically, what you would have expected is every mass is proportional to V because they all have to go to 0 when V goes to 0. If V goes to 0, the Higgs did not get a VeV, So that means we never broke any symmetries, and so then the symmetry SU2 cross U1 forbade all the masses. So what we're expecting here is that all the masses in the problem are proportional to V because it was a precondition to have a mass that V be non-zero. But then V is the same for everybody because it's just one Higgs is getting a VeV. So the second preconceived idea you might have had is that all the masses should be roughly the same, because if they all couple with kind of the same strength, then the mass will be the size of the Higgs VeV times the coupling to that VeV, and if all the couplings are the same, all the masses will be the same. And if all the couplings are kind of generic coupling sizes, like 0.1 or not particularly exotic, then like the top quark mass says, or the W boson, you remember, Mw is about 80 GeV, Mz is about 90 GeV. So these are within factors of two of each other. They are kind of roughly in the same ballpark. The interesting thing that's hard to understand in the standard model about masses is that all the other quarks are pretty light compared to that. You know, the bottom quark is 5 GeV, and then it goes down from there. And so in the standard model, that all comes in by assuming that these Yukawa couplings are just extremely small. For some reason, the Yukawa coupling for the electron is 10 to the minus 6 or 7 or something like that. And so there's no understanding in the theory as to why that should be true. But given that you choose it to be small, it's consistent. So and I'll come back to that later on, because that's kind of one of the puzzles of the standard model. I think that's all I want to say about that. Any questions about that so far? So that's the masses. I want to have one more. It's useful to have a symmetry understanding of as much as possible in the spectrum of the standard model or any theory, because if you understand what the symmetries are that are responsible for relationships amongst masses, even approximate symmetries or exact symmetries, then it gives you a sense as to how big the corrections should be to the leading order predictions. An exact symmetry will give you an exact statement, so that Mw1 is equal to Mw2. But an approximate symmetry will say that the only corrections to the formula you found have to be as big as the biggest coupling which breaks the symmetry. And so that tells you something about how big the correction should be. And so in particular, the mass formula, I want to take a detour here to talk about the mass formula we found for the W bosons. So this is, I want to talk about this, what's called the custodial SU2 symmetry, approximate symmetry. Because it's one of the clues as to the structure of the Higgs sector that we're talking about. So we had this relationship, Mw equal over Mz is equal to cosine theta W. And the question is, that's not enforced by a symmetry, an exact symmetry of the problem. Corrections actually do change this formula. But it's a good expression for what's seen in nature once you measure these three things. And it's not true generically for different kinds of models. If you take more than one doublet or you do other things, or a triplet, actually doublets will always tend to give you this. But one of the exercises has you do the same thing where you take the Higgs and have it be a triplet field. You can choose the quantum numbers of a triplet to give masses to everybody. And that does not give you this particular formula. And so it's useful to know how robust this formula is and what it relies on. And there's a way of thinking about this as being a consequence of an approximate symmetry, which in the standard model allows you to think about how big the corrections will be to this formula. So it helps to think about what was possible as being if you have four bosons, we have, you know, we have a mass term for W1, W2, W3, and B were our fields. If we were to write down a mass term for those things and ask what's the most general thing consistent with electromagnetic invariance, say, then what we would expect is that we've already seen that W1 and W2 have to have the same mass because they're related to one another by electromagnetic transformations. So we have to have the unit matrix in here to have that, to have this mass matrix be invariant under rotations of W1, W2. So we have to have M1 and M2 squared, 0, 0 for M1 squared, the same mass in both places. What I'm writing here is this is the most general mass term consistent with unbroken U1 electromagnetic invariance. Given that the W1, W2 carry charge 1, and the photon, one combination of these guys is massless. So that has to be the unit matrix. This has to be 0, the matrix, for the same reason. And this can be an arbitrary 2x2 matrix, but it has to have a 0 eigenvalue because the photon has to be massless if U1 is unbroken. So if we wrote this, let me use the same notation as I wrote in the book. So M3, M0, and M. So if you write this as being M3 squared, M squared, this has to be some sort of symmetric matrix, M0 squared. This could have been M1 squared, M2 squared, M3 squared a priori, but these were equal to each other because of the U1 invariance. Then the condition that this has a 0 eigenvector is that the determinant is 0. Which is M0 squared, M3 squared. So there's one condition that we can always use to remove M0 in terms of M3 and M. Now we're looking for a formula that connects the masses to theta. And so what theta is in this picture is it's the amount of the rotation that takes us to the, when we diagonalize this matrix, there'll be a rotation that takes us to the eigenvectors, and the non-zero eigenvector and the zero eigenvector are obtained by this rotation cosine theta, or this rotation theta. So the massive eigenvector, you remember, was in this basis was cosine theta w minus sine theta w. And the massless one is sine theta w cosine theta w. That's how theta was defined. And so I can use that to solve for theta in terms of the elements of the mass matrix there. So that implies that, let me write out what theta is. And rather than doing it in real time, let me just quote the answer. So tan theta is mw squared over m3 squared, which is m0 over m3. So if I use this condition of the determinant, that's the same thing as m0 over m3. So I'm using the m's. So if I ask what's the non-zero eigenvalue now here, it's I can write it in terms of theta. So the simplest way to get the non-zero eigenvalue is take the trace of that 2x2 matrix, because one of the eigenvalues is 0, so the trace is equal to the non-zero eigenvalue. So the non-zero eigenvalue, so M non-zero. So this is what we would call the Z mass, I guess. Is the trace of so that's just m3 squared, m0 squared. And if I use this to eliminate m0 here, I guess, in terms of theta, this is m3 squared 1 plus 10 squared theta. So that's m3 squared secant squared theta w. So this shows us that M3 is always equal to MZ cosine theta W, as long as that's what electromagnetic invariance tells us. So that's always true. So if we want this to be true, MW was not M3. MW was M1, right? This is M1 is MW. So the statement that this is true is the statement really that M3 is equal to M1 is equal to M2. So MW equals m1 equals mz cos theta is the same thing as saying that m1 is equal to m3 equals mw. So the kind of symmetry which would enforce this condition is a symmetry which makes this upper 3x3 block into the unit matrix. That's what that says. So that would be something which rotates these three W's as an orthogonal 3x3 rotation. So MW equals MZ cos theta would be a consequence, or is a consequence. Let's say would be. Symmetry of the form W1, W2, W3 goes to an orthogonal matrix times W1, W2, W3. And an orthogonal 3x3 matrix, that's like a rotation in three dimensions. That's equivalent to an SU2 transformation. You can think of that as being SU2. That's why this is called a custodial SU2. That's the transformation we're thinking of. And you think of that because if you want this symmetry to be a symmetry of the Lagrangian, you have to now go ask, is this a symmetry? And you can make it a symmetry of the gauge couplings of the W's to the fermions, which involve, remember, the gauge couplings are things like up bar, down bar, Pauli matrix, things like you've got fermion bar, gauge field, Pauli matrix, fermion. So if we use the lepton doublet, say we would have had electron, neutrino electron, neutrino electron here being mixed by the Pauli matrices. If we had quarks, it would be up down, up down. Now, if you want these guys to rotate by an orthogonal rotation, you can make this thing invariant for the W's now. You can make it invariant if these guys rotate by an SU2 transformation acting on these two-component spinners. So if we have UD goes to a unitary 2x2 transformation times UD at the same time as these guys rotate, then that would be that's something we can do because SU2 is the same thing as O3. That would preserve that would make this gauge interaction invariant. Unfortunately, the whole Lagrangian is not invariant under this symmetry, and you can kind of see that from this because the mass terms give these guys very different masses. So the Yukawa couplings in the Lagrangian differentiate between the two kinds of the up and the down parts of a doublet. And so the Yukawa couplings don't commute with this transformation where are not invariant under the transformation where you rotate these quarks into one another and you rotate the W's into one another. So this can be promoted to a symmetry of the SU, of the color of the strong interactions, because those don't involve the W's at all in the Higgses. As well as of the SU2 transformations, interactions. So that part of the standard model Lagrangian is invariant under this kind of transformation, provided we make the quarks transform. But once we've done that, it's not invariant it's not an invariance of the Yukawa couplings or of the U1 hypercharge couplings. Yeah, let me write this last thought and then ask a question. Of the U1 couplings or the Yukawa couplings. 9 times the 4th equals 0. Good thing I erased it. Yeah, I wrote it wrong. It's so I morally owe you a penny. So to the extent that you make a symmetry breaking sector for the gauge symmetries, if you can make it an approximate, to a good approximation, satisfy that the vacuum is not ruined by this kind of a transformation, then you'll get this successful mass formula, Mw is equal to Mz cosine theta. Now, is this transformation a symmetry of the vacuum? Well, I haven't told you how the Higgs transforms, but you can infer what it does given what the W transforms. So for it to be a symmetry of the W interactions, I have to also tell you what the Higgs does. And for the Higgs, so phi, you remember, was a doublet with had a charged piece and a neutral piece, both of which are complex. If I write this as being, you know, phi 1 plus I phi 2, let me write that one as being phi 1 plus I phi 2 over root 2. And I write this one as being phi 4 plus I phi 3 over root 2, where I've got the 4 first, the real part is 4. Then I can write an equivalent way of writing the scalars would be as a big monster column vector. I could instead write capital phi as, you know, phi 1, phi 2, phi 3, phi 4. And that's, they're all real in that case, because I've taken the real imaginary parts. And you know the kinetic terms, that was just minus, you know, d mu phi dagger d mu phi. That's also minus 1/2 d mu capital phi transpose d mu capital phi. And that's invariant under a 4x4 orthogonal rotation of these things. So this kinetic term has more symmetry than the gauge interactions have, say. The gauge interactions break, the U1 interaction, for instance, breaks that symmetry. But the SU2 interaction doesn't break that symmetry. The SU2 interaction does break the symmetry under rotation of all four of them, but it doesn't break the symmetry where you rotate the top three. So if I have these guys, if I ask for the O3 transformation that rotates these top three guys, that's a symmetry of the SU2 coupling to the W's if I rotate the W's at the same time. And that's kind of why these three guys at some level are being eaten by the three W's. If we didn't have the U1 transformations around to mix the Z, make the Z a linear combination of B and W3, if the Z was actually W3, we would have had a complete symmetry of the Higgs interactions, the couplings to the W's, if I simultaneously rotate these guys, because that would just be the gauge, that would just be the SU2 left gauge group. So the property, I've chosen it such that phi 4 is the real part down here. That's the thing that's non-zero in the vacuum. So in the vacuum, this was 0, 0, 0, v over root 2. And so that rotation is a symmetry that's not broken by the vacuum. And so it's an important feature of the standard model potential that it preserves a symmetry. The vacuum preserves a larger symmetry than just SU2 left. As far as the Higgs is concerned, there's a whole O3. As far as the Higgs is concerned, the SU2 left acts on the Higgs in such a way that there's a whole SU2 in here that's being unbroken by the expectation value of the Higgs. And that is the one that is also rotating the W's, and so that's the one that's responsible for this mass formula, Mw is equals Mz cosine theta. Where was I going with that? You might have said, well, so this is really only a symmetry of the standard model. To show that this is a symmetry of the standard model, it has to also be a symmetry of the other places where the scalar field couples to things. It's not a symmetry of the Higgs and of the Yukawa interactions, because those distinguish the up and down quarks. But what about the scalar potential? So it's the scalar potential. You remember that was v was a function of it was lambda phi dagger phi minus v squared over 2 squared. And so in phi dagger phi is just capital phi transpose phi. And so that's explicitly O4 invariant. So the dynamics of the Higgs scalar the potential was only asked, we only asked it to be SU2 cross U1 invariant. And the SU2 is acting, is the O3 that's rotating these three guys into one another. That SU2 cross U1 sits inside of O4, but is not the whole group O4. And this potential, which is the most general potential which is consistent with SU2 cross U1 invariance, also by accident has an O4 invariance, because if I write it this way, you can kind of see explicitly that I can rotate all four of these guys into each other and not change the form of the potential. If we had included non-renormalizable terms, so things involving more than four powers of phi, you can write things down which are SU2 cross U1 invariant, which are not O4 invariant. And so this invariance of the potential under this full O4 is an accident. So V has an accidental and that's part of what allows the potential, that's part of the reason why we know the VEV is it can be made O3 invariant, and we know that the thing that's the scalar self-interactions are not breaking this this symmetry which is underlying this custodial symmetry. These accidental symmetries are interesting because so accidental means that it's something which was not demanded. We didn't design the potential to be O4 invariant. We only demanded that it be SU2 cross U1 invariant. And it's also not true if we go beyond the renormalizable terms. And those kind of symmetries are important because they're symmetries that are not there. Gauge symmetries are there as a point of principle, that the couplings of the spin 1 particles wouldn't have made sense without the gauge symmetries. But this accidental symmetry is just something which is for free. And so we're going to see that there are other accidental symmetries in the Standard Model, baryon number and lepton number. And those are actually seen to be very good symmetries in nature. And one of the beauties of the Standard Model is that they are not required of the Standard Model. Nowhere along the construction of the Standard Model was it asked that we preserve baryon number or lepton number. And if you don't stop at the renormalizable terms and write, and you start writing non-renormalizable terms, you can break lepton number and baryon number. But it happens that the renormalizable interactions by themselves, once you've made them SU2 cross U1 invariant and color invariant, just don't have enough, they're not complicated enough to break these baryon number and lepton number symmetries. So a pretty picture in the Standard Model is that baryon number and lepton number emerge as an accidental symmetry in the same way that this O4 symmetry emerges for the scalar sector. And I'll say more about that later, but it's really beautiful that the symmetries you get that you don't ask for are exactly the symmetries that you see in nature with the Standard Model. And that's probably a good place to stop. So what I'll do next time is I'll write the gauge interactions out. That's the main thing to do next, because those are the ones that we're going to use when we calculate things. Thanks for talking to Frida.